This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio, and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, who's not here tonight, that's why I'm driving, and me, Samuel Mann. Each week we talk with someone who is making a positive difference in applying their skills to a positive future. In our conversations we try to find out what motivates them and what it means to see the world through a sustainable perspective, through their sustainable lens. Tonight's sustainable lens is that of Glenys Kerr, who is a colleague of mine. She variously described herself as a career practitioner, educator, and she has got more degrees than anybody. I think it's seven, and she is almost at the point of having a doctorate of professional studies because it's getting submitted in the very near future. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, where did you grow up?
Geraldine.
What was it like growing up in Geraldine?
I guess it's the perfect childhood. Small town, everybody knew each other, everybody did everything together, so lots of sports, church, guides, yeah. Great growing up.
Yeah. What were your parents doing in Geraldine?
My dad was self-employed, he was a milk vendor, and my mum was a nurse, palliative care nurse.
And what did you want to be when you grew up?
At what age?
Early teenage. Getting past the astronaut and the train driver.
The dancer and the fairy. I probably wanted to be a nurse, but my mum was a nurse. So at a teenage years, you don't do what your mother is. So I decided I'd be a teacher.
What did you think that being a teacher would let you achieve?
One of the first things I liked about teaching was all those holidays, but I had some really good role models as teachers at Geraldine High School, and I loved the way they influenced young people. So I think primarily it was if I could influence people that appealed to me.
So you went off to Teachers College?
I did a one-year course at then Community College, Timaru, South Canterbury Community College, in secretarial studies, so accounting, business management type stuff, and did a stint in those days, work experience as a legal secretary. And while I loved that life, I didn't like the sort of the role of the secretary. And while I was there, at Polytech, the teacher was sick, and I said, oh, I'll take the class. And unbeknown to me, the people from Training College were there. And that is really how I got into teaching, because they thought I was the teacher. So I went off and did, what was it called in those days? Commerce, I guess. Yeah, so I went off to Training College. So it was a bit of luck, really.
And did the teaching education deliver on what you hoped it would?
Yeah, it did. I mean, those are early years, late 70s, and they kind of they let you, I guess, experience teaching. So you got to play. You got to and the lecturers were you might even know one of them, Bert McConnell. He was my history teacher at Geraldine, and then he ended up at Training College. And so it was kind of neat. But it was that sort of playground of figuring out how to turn kids on to learning, which I loved. The subject area was totally irrelevant. I mean, economics and accounting, it's the most boring topic. So, but also at training college, you could take off and do other things. So outdoor ed, that kind of thing appealed to me.
Did you find yourself teaching?
Yep. Oh, yeah. Well, I've been teaching ever since in some form or other. Yeah, so initially secondary and then back to the polytech that I first studied in, so Timaru, Aoraki, and then AUT, and then to Otago Polytech. So all sort of sectors, I guess, of tertiary, yeah.
What led you from high school to tertiary?
I came home because one of my parents was sick and I was teaching at two schools in Timaru. I went back to Geraldine to look after my mother. And someone found out I was there and said, oh, you wouldn't come to the Polytech and teach. And I went, you want me to come back to teach? 10 years ago I was a student. And that's how it started. And I loved adult teaching. So people tended to come to Polytech because they wanted to. Whereas secondary school, kids went to school because they had to. So there was quite a shift. So that was exciting, really.
All right, so how did you get from there to careers, practice and education?
Yeah, that's another story. So I taught at Aoraki. I tended to teach sort of certificates and diplomas in office systems, business type programs, and a lot of outreach programs. So I'd be putting typewriters in my car and roaring off to Twizel and teaching in the tennis pavilion. And I loved that kind of life. And then, how did I get from there to where?
Careers.
Oh, careers. Then I went to Auckland and decided to have a break from teaching and bought a cafe in the heart of Auckland. And then I taught unskilled people to work in cafes. But I guess my heart wasn't teaching, and AUT had a job, a part-time job going in student services. So I went into the learning centre and helped people learn, you know, who needed extra support. And then the director of student services at the time set up a career centre. And I ended up temping in there. And then one day I thought, I can do this. And at the same time, they created the grad dip in career development, or grad cert first. So I thought, oh, I'll study that. I thought teaching, career development, there's some similarities and there's some differences. So that's kind of, I fell into that too. But again, if you look at the theme, helping people figure out what they want to do and be helping them learn, there is a sort of a theme there.
Where do you think that theme came from initially?
Well, it's really interesting. It's not till you've grown up that you actually accept that you are your parents' daughter. And my father had other jobs, a traffic officer and a mechanic, and he actually liked working for himself. He was autonomous, independent, and kind of ahead of his time. And so he picked self-employment. So in a way, there's a theme for me, is that independence. And the other is my mother was in the field of helping people. So her nursing career took her into social work. Then there was a time where she went and lived in people's homes and cared for sick people. She was in the hospital system. She was in the hospice system. And in a way, that's all about helping people, isn't it? So I think I'm my parents' daughter, really.
And you've certainly inherited somehow that entrepreneurial spirit.
Yeah, very much so.
Not just in businesses, but audacious ideas and going off in different directions.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a way of being, isn't it? Taking risks and saying yes to things rather than confining yourself. Yeah.
So when you actually eventually sat down to do a master's in career development, was it stuff that you knew, or was that an eye-opener for you?
The master's was amazing because it was an Australian program, and it was like there's plenty of open scope to what you chose to learn, and they took you through sort of almost a generic career development and then a specialist and then a very strategic, so it fitted my personality. But the supervisor of the program liked the different students, and there were two of us who never saw the world as it was, and we ended up lecturing on their master's program. So I think that, again, that was a lecturer or a teacher that sparked my interest. And I saw career not just as a career counsellor helping people in redundancies or getting a job or writing a CV. I saw it much bigger than that. So, yes, it did open my mind and lift my thinking to a different level, which kind of meant I could do anything I wanted.
Do you have something resembling a philosophy of learning?
Well, it depends what you mean when you ask that question. Learning is something that you do. And I think bastardized it. In a way, we believe that it's our job, we're the experts, and we should tell people what they need to think and learn. And I don't believe that. If you go back to little kids, they don't learn by being told what to do. They learn by observing and watching and doing and making mistakes. And I think you and I have talked about the child that learns to tie their shoelace. They didn't go to a lecture to learn that. They didn't read a book. You know, it's practice. And I think learning should be confined. It shouldn't be confined. It should be fun. People should want to keep learning. I mean, I don't know what it would be like to stop learning. So it should be a way of being rather than something that you sign up for.
So where did that vision and that passion for that vision come from? Did you when you went to Teachers College, you were able to experiment.
Yeah.
But did it come from before that?
Oh, it must have. Because if you look at my, you know, as a young child, like 8, 9, I was in charge of the brownies, and then I took girl guides out on tramps, and I taught young people how to do stuff. So I think, is it in your DNA? So I think I've always had that love. I don't think I learnt it at training college. I think training college gave me the opportunity to experiment how you could turn kids on to learning.
In terms of career practice, you say it's more than teaching people how to do a CV. When does it start? Do we start it too late, too early?
Yeah.
Where do people get these ideas?
About what they want to do and be and think. Usually at primary school. Career development should be then. I mean, it's really neat if you can think back to when you were 4 or 5, you probably wanted to be a fireman or, I don't know, what did you want to do at 5, Sam?
Not sure what I wanted to do at 5. Through high school, I wanted to be a set designer.
A what?
Set designer.
Right. Oh, in movies and, yeah. So I think those ideas stem from a very young age, and they usually stem from role models, don't they? You watch what someone does and you go, I wonder what that's called that they do. I mean, as a young child, I wanted to be a policewoman. I wanted to help people. I wanted to, but I was too short in those days. And I did want to be a nurse. So that it starts at such an early age, and it's up to parents and all sorts of people to motivate or grow that, you know, I wonder what you could be. And I think also the downside is perhaps for young people today is they could be anything if they only knew what it was, because it's information overload.
Do you think that we not scare that out of people, but almost beat it out of them, this desire to do something, achieve something, but then we label it and we make them do accounting or economics and things through high school, and all of a sudden they're not changing the world, they're being an accountant.
Yeah, they're confined. And I think that's often the people that have a part to play in that role. Like, I always am amused sometimes when kids love history at school, so the teacher tells them to be a history teacher. I mean, seriously? Why don't they brainstorm all of the things a kid could do because of their love of history? And, you know, then the traditional kid that's good at sport, well, you need to do phys ed. And so we turn them off. We haven't been creative about what that could be. And I think that at our era growing up, we had to be something. When I grow up, I'm going to be a doctor, a nurse, a policeman, a fireman, a secretary, whatever. Kids these days, they grow up and we're teaching them that they have a range of skills, a range of interests. And so then the hard bit is, well, what could that look like? So we don't want to stifle that in young people. I mean, I talked with someone today and she said, I'm just a. You know, that makes me sad. And I said, wow, I've just looked at your CV and I don't even understand the words you've got in it. That's awesome what you do. I have no idea. And she kind of went, what do you mean you don't know? And I went, I don't understand what what you've written down. So tell me about that. Her eyes lit up, but she still was just a. That's very sad.
So you and I work for Capable New Zealand.
Yeah.
And you can give us the introduction to what it is.
Well, Capable New Zealand is an innovative school, part of the Polytech, that's probably in the business of helping or supporting or guiding people who already have significant skills and knowledge, significant experiences, and they want to grow and enhance that, change it, open it up, shake it a bit. It's not for younger people with no experience because they do need to go and learn about stuff. But these people come in and often they want their skills and knowledge from experience validated against a qualification. And we help them do that. And I guess the fun bits about that are people have horrendously amazing skills and knowledge. They just don't know that. And so the reflective process that we take them through helps them to really think about, actually, they know a lot. And then that, as that confidence grows and that knowledge and awareness happens, they're open to new thinking, new learning, new ideas. So that's what's fun about where we work.
And that is the subject for your doctorate.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yes, it was the subject. Is it was yet? No.
No. You have to actually hand it in for it to be was.
Oh, okay. So I set out to survey over 400 people who had undertaken two qualifications. I picked those two because they're the most popular. So the Bachelor of Applied Management and the Bachelor of Social Services, and they had gone through an intensely reflective process with us, and I wanted to know what they learned, what they thought about, what changed, what they're doing now, as well as what could we do better. You know, that's always good, because 99% of those people had a successful journey, successful learning process, and their lives had changed. And for me, how neat is to write about that.
In what way had their lives changed?
They had a new language. They had a set of skills that they actually believed they now had. It gave them the confidence to challenge new jobs or take on new directions or continue learning. So a lot of people have gone on to do masters, and I'm sure they'll be back to do the doctorate, which we're going to be offering, aren't we, Sam?
Almost there.
Almost there, yeah. So confidence, identity, new brands, new language, all those things happen.
In what way is it new learning? In which way is it ticking off the boxes of the stuff they've already got?
Yeah, well, a lot of people hope that they're ticking off the boxes, and that isn't what it's about. So often the first piece of new learning is understanding how to reflect, how to go, how do I know that? Where did I learn that? All those questions that you just asked me, I know that because it's inherent in my upbringing. You know, I can't lie about where I grew up. But, you know, the first job, what did you learn? How did you learn how to take kids tramping at 11 years old? What did you do about risk? And so people love that because it takes them back to stuff they'd done. And so often the first bit of new learning is to learn how to reflect. And I'm always blown away when people haven't. And so then the next bit of learning is often how to write differently, write professionally, not necessarily academically, but to write coherent sentences that make sense, that sum up information. Some people learn how to research, how to find out stuff about more about stuff, to be curious. Some people learn that they actually have a lot of skill and knowledge, that they have an identity. So they no longer say, I'm just. So there's lots of learning. So, and then people invariably at the end of the learning process, they pull together their skills and knowledge into sort of a framework or a model, a practice. And then you see the old me and the new me. And that's quite transformational.
Does learning have to be transformational?
Well, I guess it depends on your belief about what transformation means. And usually transformation is a result of something. It changes. And it changes and it has an impact on you for today and the future. And I think sometimes people just don't understand what transformation means. So even the kid that learnt to tie their shoelace at 5 is transformational. Though they probably won't say that.
How do they learn how to transfer that new learning about themselves or this transformation about themselves to their new self?
It comes out in many ways because part of the assessment process, so a lot of it is written reflection, so they do have to do that. And they often get evidence to attest to stuff they've done. But then they sum up and they orally articulate who they are and what they are and why they are and what their values and beliefs are and what they've learned to a panel of assessors. And as they speak out loud, they start to believe, more so than writing it down. And so we see the transformation, we see the new language, the confidence, the identity that's changed. And often you'll see it in their CV. Or even just in the way they talk about themselves. When they say, this is who I am, and what I am, and why I am, they couldn't say that at the start. And also the fact that two people who have experience are assessing them, so they know it's kosher.
When we talk about developing sustainable practitioners, one of the sorts of things we're looking for are not, it's not as simple as saying that we want them to make sure they've got the recycling sorted
and the light bulbs. Yeah.
It's very much a sort of a set of attributes, systems thinking, critical thinking, creative thinking. Is that something, do those things come through that reflective process?
Yeah, and in many ways and in many different ways. So often in social services, you'll often hear people not only thinking about their own self-care in horrendous jobs, they're thinking about supporting other people to have safe lives and healthy lives. And and also their communities. But I was trying to think of all of the things that you come through. I mean, sustainability is also developing skills for the future. It's not, I mean, it's quite interesting. They often start out with the light bulbs and the recycling, and then they start to you know, push that out around economic stability, sustainability, social sustainability, and it's kind of neat to see that happen. But it does come out, and if it hasn't, naturally we talk about that. We bring in people like you to talk about it.
When they've gone through this sort of process, do you need to sort of like cover each of those things, or if you can have a decent conversation with about ethical frameworks, does that sort of like go wider to things like sustainability?
Yeah. I mean, you've got to see it as a holistic process rather than a discrete set of tasks. And often the learner can't do that at the start. And in a way, we're a connector, a joiner of dots. We help them start integrating stuff. And that's kind of neat to watch too, because, you know, a lot of people do control their life by putting it in boxes. And of course, we know that that isn't so. So it's the whole self as well. And you see that ability by the time they've finished to combine information and knowledge and thinking.
Do you think it's an easier process than going to class?
No, I don't, but I think it's a more valuable process, a more acknowledging process that people have spent 20, 30 years of their life developing skills and knowledge and learning from it, to recognise it and acknowledge it and validate it. So it's sometimes it's hard because we're stretching people, that we're not just, there's always new learning, so we're pushing them. And if you can see that they have a strength in sustainability or business improvement or HR development, we're pushing them all the time. It's a stretch for them. And I'll often hear learners say, "I hated you." And so we you know.
You're talking about yourself there, not me.
Yeah. No, sometimes. so that's part of it. But it's not easier. It's just more validating when you're an adult. And you can't equate it.
So all other things being equal, if you were advising an 18-year-old that was choosing, should I go and do this work or should I do this degree? And if I go down the work route, I'll go through a reflective process later. How would you balance that?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because usually young people don't make decisions on their own. They're highly influenced by their family. They want to make their mum and dad proud, or their parents have huge influence where they're expecting them to do that BCom, and then they can do what they like after that. Or they're influenced by their peers. So everyone's going to uni to do a BCom, so we'll all do that. And I think that's the sad bit and the hard bit. Some people quite naturally have a disposition to want to go to university or polytech straight away and get stuck into learning new stuff and being part of a class environment, and that's really cool. And some people, like I've got quite a few kids, that actually needed to work and figure out what it is they actually love. And it's okay. Doesn't matter when you do your study or learning or how you do it. So I think there's no one size fits all. But the skill of a career practitioner is to challenge the thinking of a young person. And that can be hard if mum and dad are in the career session or if their mates are, because they're highly influenced by that. But because study is so expensive, you don't want to set them up to fail. And from my experience, kids that go to uni or polytech, I'm not talking about one specific, go into higher education, and they don't enjoy it and they fail, then their loss of confidence is far greater than if they go and get a job at the supermarket for a couple of years and learn about management. So that's always of a worry to me.
I described you as a career practitioner and educator and various other things, and you described yourself in one point just then as a connector, a joiner of dots.
Yeah.
So other than doing dotted up puzzles, how do you describe yourself?
That's a hard question, because depends who asks me the question as to how I answer. But I'm in the business of transforming people's lives. And how, whatever that means, whether it's career counselling or supporting a friend or turning someone on to learning, I want to help people have a better life. The people that don't need me, that's fantastic.
What happens if their idea of a better life is quite clearly wrong?
Well, firstly, there's a whole lot of ethics in that.
I was winding you up with that question.
Oh,
but,
okay.
Let's answer it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if someone says, well, I want to learn to be a burglar and rip people off old people's homes at night, I'm probably going to challenge, you know, a whole lot of things around that and try and put them onto something where they can do something less illegal. I don't want people to do harm or do anything illegal, so I would probably have to say that. When I worked with elite athletes, one of the codes is, you know, no drug taking and things. And so you have a duty of care to people to keep them safe and to get them the support, even if they're not telling you. And career practitioners have a code of ethics too. So equally, I could have someone that comes to me who's been in jail for 10 years and actually has decided to have a better life. And so it's about not judging that and finding a pathway.
You describe it as a facilitation process. Is that a subset of teaching, different to teaching?
It's got the same traits.
See, I know the chapters in your thesis.
I know. Yeah, it is the same as teaching, but it's student-centred learning. So if you look at the literature around what a good teacher does, they support, guide people. So, yes, that's where it is similar. But you know, I might add, we don't want to be the experts in other people's lives. We want to help them be the expert. But sometimes we need to be the expert because they're not there yet. But it's how you do that. I like to call it the dance, but you don't like that, Sam. So,
if we can presume to advise the rest of education, what could they learn from this reflective learning process?
Predominantly teachers are fantastic. I mean, I've seen some fantastic people in classrooms turning kids on to learning using, you know, applied methods. And I think that for every really, for 100 really good teachers, are probably 5 that should have left. So I actually think, by and large, they are doing the right thing. They're turning kids on. They're trying to find ways to motivate them, to help them to learn. But often that's also up to the young person. They might be in the wrong class, or they just might need to grow up a bit.
You said you never see the world as it is.
No.
What do you see?
As it could be. What's the Kennedy quote? Some people see things and say why. Yeah, I see things and say why not. I guess it's the glass half full mentality. You know, I always tell the story to my students that I sat on a bus one day to the airport when I was young, 19, And I engaged in a conversation with a much older man because, you know, I'm a chatty person and in those days you don't have cell phones or iPads. And when I got off the bus, he offered me a job in a very important company in those days. And that's how it should be. You know, and I could have said yes, but I was on a pathway where it was exciting and I didn't need that opportunity. But it's about looking for opportunities and saying yes to stuff, developing that resilience. So there's been very few times in my life that I've said no to stuff. And as a self-employed person, people would say, will you take this job on? I said yes to everything. Probably not very sustainable in terms of work-life balance, but that's how I learnt.
So in terms of not seeing the world as it is and in terms of transforming people's lives, mostly you're talking there about individuals. Do the same things apply if we scale it up? Can you do this for
groups,
societal level problems?
Yeah.
How?
Like putting people into groups, into cohorts, and working together. Is that what you mean?
No, I'm thinking about solving world hunger, sustainability.
Oh, okay.
Can we apply these sorts of principles and ideas at a much larger scale?
Yeah.
How do we go about doing that?
So to give me an example, someone comes in to see you and says, I want to solve the world, I want to save the world, I want to solve world hunger. Well, what would you say?
I would work with them to try and work out what they were talking about in terms of, as we talked with Ray and Alyssa over the last couple of weeks, about the relationship between the problem space and the solution space, and those things go around in circles, as opposed to a sort of a more traditional model of, well, just define the problem and then
the
solution will appear.
Yeah.
And I think it's, as you go round and round, you get better at understanding what's happening.
Mm. That is very cyclical, and that's it. So I'm just trying to understand that question, though, because often young people don't know what they want to do and don't know what they want to be, but they have a fundamental wish to make the world a better place. And I'd be interested to see what that could look like and how we build young people to develop skills to do that, because that's a big, bold goal, isn't it?
Yeah. Do you think that, where are we on the numbers, if you like? If we make the world a better place on the other end of a continuum, maybe we can't do this, but I'm going to do it anyway. Two, I want to drive a big car and earn lots of money.
Well, you do get that. People will often take engineering or plumbing as the latest because it's the biggest earner at the moment. The fact that they don't enjoy it and have no passion for it is totally irrelevant. They can apply themselves to learn that skill and then they can earn big money.
Is it as obvious as a gender separation on that?
No, I don't think so anymore. There's plenty of young women that have the same attitude. And so those people never go into social service type jobs. They're helping professions.
Do we have a duty of care? You talked about that duty of care that we have for our individuals. What do you think that we as educators... What's our duty of care in a much bigger perspective? What are we trying to achieve as a whole?
Well, I think the word sustainability comes into play here again. What is the future? What does it look like? How do we help people have sustainable futures? What does that look like? Because I think there's a lot of people that don't even think about that. So we have a duty to care to set people up for a future that won't look like it does now. There won't be jobs for life. There won't be the jobs that we currently have. There'll be robots doing that. And I think some people don't really appreciate that. So we do have a duty of care.
So if someone comes in and says they want to be a whatever it is that we are pretty sure isn't going to survive much longer. Do we try and talk them out of it? How do we manage that?
I don't know that you talk them out of it, but you challenge their thinking. You know, like it's the kid that says, you know, I want to be a doctor. So tell me why you want to be a doctor. What is it that a doctor does that appeals to you? Because often they have no idea. So we have a duty of care to broaden people's minds and perspectives.
Which leads me to the questions about the tensions in your data. One of the themes that came out was the people that said things to the effect of, I liked it, how nurturing they were, and how much they challenged me.
The paradox.
The paradoxes.
Yeah, well, isn't that life, the paradox? And also that helps people develop resilience. You don't want them to want to only be nurtured. So the skill of a facilitator is knowing when to be what. You know, if they're having a vulnerable moment, you're not going to push them at that moment. You are going to be kind and caring. But then you're going to slowly push them, keep them moving.
Do you think that understanding of paradoxes, is that a fundamental thing that's missing from our whole education? We're too good at teaching people black and white. Well, that's what we tend to do, and it's actually the subtleties that matter.
Yeah, and I think, but I start to see a lot of people using a lot more case studies, real life issues these days where they are exposed to that. You know, when you're 18 and you're trying to fill someone's little brain up with a whole lot of knowledge and information, it's quite an interesting concept, isn't it? So there needs to be a lot more applied sort of practical exercises, really scary ones.
You talked about there won't be jobs for life. What is the future of work?
Well, the future of work, certainly not no job for life, and for people to be really adaptable, flexible, mobile. So what's really interesting is facilitators work differently. We seldom work with learners between 9 and 5 because our learners are at work. They're online with us at 8 o'clock at night when their kids are in bed or they've got an hour. Or Saturday morning. And so we work differently. And so that flexibility, that ability to go, oh, I've got nothing on this afternoon, I might go to the gym and get the groceries and go and visit a couple of people because tonight I'll be working. It's a total mind shift. So it wouldn't matter if there wasn't anyone in the office, Sam, because they'll all be working differently. And also that whole self-employment thing. You're only as good as your last contract. And so people have to understand what that means. There's no expectation of an employer funding your lifestyle that you think you deserve. Those kind of things are gone.
We have this idea in education that we'd like to be doing things, something about lifelong learning.
But yeah.
Are we really?
Well, I like to think so. If you turn people on to learning and motivate and enthuse and inspire people and find the things that do spark their interest, then surely that lifelong learning doesn't mean doing what I did and doing a whole range of qualifications. Learning doesn't have to be attached to anything. I mean, what did you learn today? Can you tell me 5 new things you learned?
I could. It might take a while to think through them. Yes, I think I could.
Yeah, so just tell me one thing that you learnt that was new for you today.
Well, I've been in assessments all day, so I need to be careful about what I'm talking about with the individuals. But there's some ways of that people have matched their professional framework to what they're doing, which has actually been quite interesting things, and the different models that people are using for doing that was really interesting today. And that the difficulties of applying standard research methods to this kind of stuff, the recognizing that the work that people are doing, particularly at the master's level, we can't simplify. It's not we can't do research by reducing everything down to a single factor and just testing that, because people are in their messy work, and the participants in their research are their boss and their colleagues and the people they're managing and their customers, and we need to pull all that together. So there is really different things about what we're doing. So I had some insights about that.
Yeah.
About that today.
That's why the literature on work-based learning is exciting, because it kind of explains that. That will be hard for some people to transfer their thinking from traditional research and academia to professional practice. I think that's a leap, isn't it? Because you don't have to attach your thinking to 50 other theorists that said something.
And the challenge, as work is changing, but particularly at the master's level, but also to some extent at the undergrad, is that people are describing jobs that, well, they're doing them, but don't exist as a recognised discipline, despite the fact that they're doing that work.
Mm.
So they're defining their own framework of practice.
Yeah, and also you will be hearing cross-disciplinary approaches. So traditionally people studied subjects like business, social services, accounting, nursing. What about the people in work where they don't, like today I had a good example, a lot of people didn't line up to anything. So our professional practice qualifications are perfect because it's about their professional practice, which is multidisciplinary. It's management, it's economics, it's accounting, it's business improvement. It doesn't fit under something. It's melded together. And then all of a sudden there's a new project, so they're off doing quantity and quality control. And they just I also don't think people understand how resilient they are, where they go, yep, it's new, it's all part of the job. And yet they're still working in the same organisation, but they're doing complex work. And so that's another thing. People aren't going to be subject-specific. They're going to be very integrated. And so I think our professional practice qualifications are a wee bit ahead of its time for some people, because they keep thinking, oh, is that management then, or what fits under there? So it's kind of neat when they get to that point. We just need an undergrad there.
I'm getting there.
Yeah.
Okay, some questions to end with. What's your go-to definition of sustainability?
Oh, Sam.
You can't just say, I'd ask Sam.
Yeah, well, that's one on the spot. I don't have one. I'd have to think about that.
What do you say to a learner that says, why should I care about this stuff?
What would I say to them? Well, why shouldn't you care? You know, usually people come from communities that they do care about. They care about the land. They care about the people. So then you find that when you say, oh, well, so in 10 years' time when there's no fresh water, they start to think about it and they do start to make changes. And different communities see it quite differently. But people don't say that to me, Sam. Why should I care? And even young people don't say that anymore. I think young people have got a much bigger sense of social responsibility. I think that era is past of leaving the tap running while you clean your teeth.
But you're not finding people saying, oh, but I'm a insert discipline here. It doesn't apply to me.
No, I'm not. I see some people not looking at it in its full depth, but when you show them places to find out about it, they always come back with really rich stuff and new stuff that you wouldn't have thought about. And I think that's neat where they figure it out. But you're just doing some prompts like, well, what about this? Yeah. I'll have to think of a good throwaway definition, though. That's
What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
You know, my passion, transforming lives, I know that, but my passion is the second chance learners. I love the people that university or higher ed or polytech wasn't for their family. It wasn't for them. And so they left school at 15 and got a job. And then, you know, a lot of the athletes I work with that hit rugby or cricket at a young age, and sport was their identity. And sometimes English is a second or third language. I love those. I love helping them make a difference. So I think that's where, if I had a choice, that's where I'd stay. I'll leave the masters for you, Sam. But I'll do the review of learning and the themes in your life. So it's helping people who didn't think that this was for them, being the first in the family.
So we're writing a book of these interviews. We're calling it Tomorrow's Heroes. So what is the superpower that you're bringing to the team? Not the one you wish for, the one you have.
The superpower?
Yeah.
Oh, maybe you have to tell me. I don't know.
And you see, the thing about these superpowers is that they're not magical. That's the point. They are things that everybody could have and does have variations on.
Well, I don't know. A superpower.
Is it a belief that you can... I'm going to put words in your mouth here. Is it a belief that you can make a difference for other people, with other people?
I don't have an ego that it's about me. So it's never about me. I mean, my motivation is when you see their families at graduation and you see them cross the stage. I don't need to be important in that process. So I need to make that clear, even though it's kind of cool when they go, thanks, Glenys, I really hated you. It's more that I've turned them on to something they never thought was for them. And I guess turning people on to learning is important to me, however that learning is. I'm not necessarily qualification focused, but for some people, they do want a qualification. Our oldest learner is 86. He wants to graduate with his great-grandson. How awesome is that?
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Oh, gosh. What is the definition of an activist?
You get to define it. Someone, in your answer.
Someone who sets out to make a difference? Someone who sets out to change the world?
If we go for that, are you one of those?
Yeah. Oh, and superpowers and activists.
Okay.
I don't use those words, Sam.
So, what motivates you? You said families at graduation, but that can't get you out of bed every day.
Well, it does, actually. Helping people does get me out of bed all day. Making a difference, watching that spark of interest. And, you know, sometimes it takes 5 or 6 months to see it. But I always like looking for the glue. I don't care. You know how people tell you a story. I don't always listen for the facts. I listen for perhaps what isn't said. I listen for the glue, and then I come back to it. And people talk about that, and I often don't know how I know, but I find it, or the gold. That's fun. I can dine out on that for hours if I've found that for someone.
So not trying to be an expert on their lives, but perhaps some sort of magic mirror.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you are the expert for a while because you can see they're struggling, so you are guiding them and giving them more help and information for a while, and it's knowing when to let that go. It's just not that whole traditional, I'm the expert and you'll listen to me for 2 hours while I talk at you.
Okay. We've got a minute to get through more 3 questions. Biggest challenge you're looking forward to in the next year?
Oh, actually, is crossing the stage with that red gown. It's never been about the graduation, but somehow I think it will be.
If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur tomorrow morning, what would you like to have happen?
Personally or professionally?
You can pick.
That everybody could afford to learn, to study, to get those qualifications, to make a difference. That education was free.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Well, if you are one of those people out there that have significant skills and knowledge from experience and would like to see if that matches something, I'd love to talk to you.
That sounds fantastic. Thank you very much. You've been listening to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio and podcast on sustainablelens.org. We hope you enjoyed the show.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.